Spoken word.
A taste of Melbourne's diverse poetry scene.
Poets using their voices to entertain, to move, to take you on a journey.
Connecting you to grassroots poetry and performance.
Good morning and welcome to the 3CR Spoken Word Program. My name is Di Cousins and I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and I pay my respects to elders past and present. And now Omar Musa is a longtime friend of the program and he's just won the Miles Franklin Award for his new novel, Fierce Land. Back in 2014, he came into the studio and performed some poetry and talked about poetry and his then new novel, Here Come the Dogs. So today we're going to listen back to Omar Musa just over 12 years ago and hear all about poetry and his adventures around the world.
Omar is originally from Queanbeyan near Canberra and first came to national attention when he won the Australian Poetry Slam in 2009. He achieved international attention after winning the Indian Ocean Poetry Slam also in 2009. Omar has published a number of poetry books and hip-hop records. His most recent book is a novel, Here Come the Dogs, which was published this year by Penguin. He is in town for the Melbourne Writers Festival. Welcome, Omar.
Hey, thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Great to see you. Now, you've received a lot of media attention recently for your first novel, but I'm interested in your poetry, and I'm wondering if you could start us off with My Generation.
Sure. My generation sat on the brim of the ocean, waiting for the tide to bring something in. My generation was populated by booze hounds and pill heads, crude clowns and bedspreads stained with the neon dreams of cocaine fiends. I mean, the diamond-flooded visions of sex kittens who sweat bullets, glitter and Chanel. I mean, the ones who live in debt to buy spray cans of fake tan. I mean, the ones who drop out of college to get collagen, hoping to hook up with pop-collar Gen Y men with copycat tattoos, footy contracts and right-angled jaws, hoping to ride amphetamine horses and red Porsches into clubs whose shelf life is over right about now. My generation took solace in false prophets who promised change and did more of the same, whose ideologies of optimism were turned into fridge magnets and bumper stickers. Yes, we can. Yes, we witnessed prime ministers slain, hush coups in the halls of parliament, heads rolled over bad polls, tongues lolled, drums rolled as newspapers harmonized like baying wolves. New kings and queens would smile for the ill-seeing camera's eyes that blink but never flinch, freshly anointed leaders with polished teeth and long knives. They would smile, but deep down they knew that the guillotine also waited for them. My generation bloomed with the blood of artists who sent messages in bottles that ended up lodged in bleached coral, and humanity was a deep fossil to be fossicked someday by a people other than us, while the traditional custodians of the land sweated in the concrete gizzards of Govo Flats, left-wing activists sipped Merlot and talked of reform. My generation had hot-buttered sex to cookie-cutter music. We made auto-tuned love. Men learned how to have sex on a curriculum of pixelated pink porn star pussy and double-D tits. Digital dicks, we made love between oil spills and massacres, tangoed between the headlines of history, flitting between hushed love-making and murder, drafts of cool wine and hellish salt pans wimpling with dancing mirages that brought brief joy to our desiccated hearts. My generation never stopped being children. We grew wearier, but not wiser. We grew older, but not up. And our only possessions were our winged imaginations, sitting on the brim of the ocean, waiting for the tide to bring something in.
Beautiful. Thank you so much.
Sorry for that little mistake there. It's all right. The blemishes make the beauty. Don't worry about that. It's all right.
No, we love it. We love it. And now that you're a few years older, do you feel that the ideas are still true for you, that you've grown older but not up?
That's a good question. I've never been asked that before. I think that's true in certain ways, that I have never really achieved any kind of revelatory wisdom, not yet at least. I'm still just working on everything. I'm still using the same principles that I want to deal with deep matters of the heart. I want to deal with life and death, and that I've got a certain type of mood swinging in my emotions that I have never been able to control. But I feel that art should be dangerous and unruly and mad, verging on reckless, and I think I've still got that, so maybe it's a good thing. I think if I became too hardened, if my skin became too thick, then I might lose it all.
I'm sure there's no danger of that. So tell me about your journey in poetry. Did you have good teachers in school?
I had a few really good teachers. I had one in year five in primary school called Ms. Leanne Patterson, and she recently came to my book launch, which was really exciting, in Canberra. But I don't know why she set this assignment to write stories or write poems. And I used to write these really gory, graphic horror stories about people getting impaled and their eyes being pulled out and things. I'm not sure why. I've always been attracted to the darkness in some way. But she must have seen a little glimmer of talent in there, because she really nurtured it and she encouraged me to keep writing stories and said, why don't you try this thing? Why don't you try this? And I started experimenting, and I just fell in love with writing, and I fell in love with poetry, and I would read poetry, and my dad had been a poet, so he would encourage me, and he liked that. And then in high school, there was a teacher called John Mazer, who also came to my book launch, and that was gratifying. He was quite an eccentric, secretive sort of Canadian guy, and he used to set these really weird assignments that I used to love, and he would give us poems and stories that were not on the curriculum, and I really liked that. He gave us this folk song about a guy whose dream it was to sleep with Madonna. And he searched high and low, and he was from this small town. And eventually, one day in his life, sort of 20 years after seeing her on TV, he eventually slept with Madonna. And then he had nothing to do with his life after that. And I think he eventually killed himself because he had no motivation anymore, had no reason to live. And he just used to set us these really bizarre things like that and get us to analyze hip-hop lyrics or things that we were listening to at the time, whereas a lot of other teachers would say, no, that's not poetry, it's not literature, but he would encourage it.
I think it's broadening when you start to read different kinds of writers and find out that there's different kinds of possibilities. Were there other particular poets that you felt were inspirational?
When I was growing up.
When you were growing up or in the last 10 years?
I think when I was growing up, I was really attracted to storytellers in poetry. So I was a really big fan of Robert Browning. We had to study him in school, but I loved that each poem was from a different point of view, different perspective, told a story, and I really liked that, and it made me realize, oh, okay, poetry doesn't have to be completely confessional and just your own story. You can inhabit all these different roles, and I found that pretty exciting. And then there was another poet, V.S. Rendra, who's a very, very famous Indonesian poet, and I met him when I was, I can't even remember, I think I was about 10 years old. There's a photo of he and I'd been forced to wear a suit by my parents. You know, an Asian father always gets his son to dress up in a suit at some point, I think, against their will. And I was standing next to Rendra, and my dad said to me, see this guy, when he performs poetry, yeah, he doesn't just read it from the page, he uses it, his whole body, and he'd do it at political rallies and to stadiums full of people, and he lives it and he breathes it, and this is the best poetry when it's performed. And I remember it had a huge impact on me when I was a young kid, because I hadn't seen anything like that, and so I was searching for it. And then I came across hip-hop music, of course, and then through that I found slam poetry. So it was that initial spark in my head, wow, poetry can be performed to a lot of people.
Yes, I think that makes all the difference when it comes alive and when you hear it and when there's a living experience of it. I think that's a completely different genre, you know, it's another level. Would you like to share another poem?
Sure. This one's called Dark Streets. You never see the reef coming till you're shipwrecked. You never understand what you write while the ink's wet. You can't tell until it's over, until you're sober, whether that girl on your sofa is a princess or a hangwoman leading you to the gallows, liver full of shadows, with bullets in the blood, lungs full of arrows, tongue cocked back, gunpowder in every step. I sniff the air like a wolf, and there they are, the dark streets where we are wraiths in a wasteland, floating over bitumen and used up spray cans, breakdance taking in the fragrance of asphalt and rain, the rumour of petrol fumes and phantoms with snowflakes in their veins. Because the dark streets flow with addiction and dread, but fuck it, here we are. Luck seekers looking for El Dorado, treasure hunters in the Sierra Madre, hoping we don't come up with fistfuls of fool's gold, but deeper we go, shedding mates like skin, betting our futures in late night casinos. We barter the love of our mothers and fathers, lovers and partners for the dark streets, seamless rivers that go from what was to what will be, with the stars above like a spilled bottle of pills. Here we are, as brave and as useless as poetry.
Oh, wow. We're going to go to a track from Further Electronics. So welcome back to 3CR Spoken Word, and we're interviewing Omar Moussa today and talking about poetry as well as his new book, Here Comes the Dogs. Now, you've been travelling a lot lately. One of the places you went to was Turkey. What did you experience there?
Well, I have a great deal of affection for Istanbul. I've been there before, and I was on my way through there to Macedonia doing research for my book. And I stopped there around the time when there were a lot of protests against the government, and I spoke to a few locals, and then I kind of had quite a crazy experience, and I wrote a whole poem about it. But I think maybe it would be best if I just read the poem, because otherwise I'll just give away the thunder.
All right, go ahead.
So this is an unfinished poem, actually, dear listeners. This is called Tear Gas Sunset, and I've never read this before, so this is a little exclusive for you guys. One. Having narrowly escaped jet lag, I ate a mushroom omelette in Galata Square with wrinkled black olives on the side like little black eyes. I washed it all down with coffee strong enough to wake the dead. As I looked upon the ancient tower, the city came to life around me. Tourists and cats and drunkards made their way across the square. Over the next few hours, I did edits on my novel, listened to an American family talk too loudly, and heard the cafe's Gypsy King CD mix with the call to prayer. I updated my Facebook. Hello, Istanbul. What a city. I love this place so much. It is rainy and muddy and musical and full of life. When I got back to the hotel, the man at reception asked me what I was doing tonight. I grinned and mimed drinking. Rakia. He smiled sadly, shook his head and said, "Be careful. The police killed a little boy. He died yesterday. He was hit in the head by a police tear gas canister nearly a year ago. The government does what it wants. The police do what they want. They do not care. I am a nationalist. I am supposed to be on the right. The communists are supposed to be on the left. But we have joined against this government. This government is fundamentalist. Do not go up Istiklal Street tonight, my friend. Last night, it was like a war. Tonight again, there will be nearly a million people and tear gas. Taksim Square will be like a war." His eyes were green and steady. My hotel room smelled of the cleaning woman's cigarettes. I looked across the rooftops and satellites with their faces to the sun and saw two minarets and the dome of a mosque across the Bosphorus. As the city readied itself for protest and mourning, I burned my lips on the sunset. 2. I got lost looking for a trendy cafe, ended up near Karakoy Port, drank homemade lemonade in a side street, climbed through an aristocratic neighborhood and found myself in Taksim Square. There were students with pictures of a young boy, Berkin Elvan, pinned to their lapels. People in beanies and ballets thronged, dressed mostly in black. Shellfish and chestnuts were roasting on portable braziers. There were choppers in the sky and so many sirens, and the whole place seethed with thousands of legs in fast forward. Istanbul was not cold, was not this cold last time. I turned a corner and came face to face with riot police, close enough to see the scratches on their semi-automatic weapons, close enough for one to blow smoke in my face. 3. When I got back to the hotel, there was a new dude behind the desk. He told me that he had worked in Taksim Square a year ago. You should have seen it, how exciting it was. His eyes shone. I like the smell of tear gas. Sometimes it is necessary. 4. 20 minutes later, cops swarmed out from every side street like termites and opened onto civilians with water cannons and tear gas. 5. Something drew me back to Taksim Square. As I walked up Istiklal, life seemed to carry on as usual. Men sipped FS from the can. Women with high cheekbones were smoked by cigarettes. Lamb cutlets smoked on grills. Mint tea steamed. Trinkets winked in the market. Shops were still open, full of bored faces. I swear to God, the look of someone who hates their job is universal. I started to see wet footprints becoming denser and denser on the concrete. Then I heard a stamping, a chanting, a banging on roller doors, the voice of a mob like the bunching and unbunching of a fist. It was up near Galatasaray High School where everything always kicks off, a square that leads north, south, east, west. I have smelled tear gas twice before, once in Malaysia, once in Guatemala, and I recognized it straight away. Then there was something like fireworks, a phosphorescent scatter, a clatter of riot shields, the twack of baton on flesh, then a cheer, and the stampede of feet, and I was running through the crowd, unsure of where I was going, and there was danger and fear, but also some laughter, and people with their arms round each other's shoulders. Istiklal had turned into a river, but there were people swimming upstream towards the maelstrom, camera phones held aloft, shining beams like little lighthouses above the crowd. 6. On the way home, a kid tried to sell me a mask to protect me from the tear gas. Just a few blocks away, things were quiet. I passed wall upon wall of graffiti, thinking, whoever DSK is, they run shit around here. The guy behind the counter was more somber now. I do not like protests. I voted. My best protest was at the election. 7. The news tells me that two people are dead. I lean out the window and the wind is cold and fleet-footed. as if it is being chased.
Thank you. How did you feel being in Turkey? Did you feel that proximity to danger?
I guess I did, but it was weird. As I said in the poem, everything was just carrying on as normal. You know, I'd gone and had a little feed. I went and wandered and bought some toys for a friend. And then all of a sudden, yeah, you see the footprints getting denser and denser, and then you're just in the heart of this complete madness. And there are people being beaten. There are people running around. There's excitement, though, along with the danger. And then that unmistakable smell of tear gas. I'd seen some protests before. Peaceful protests, actually, in Malaysia. And then all of a sudden the tear gas came out and you're starting, the snot is running out of your nose, you can't control it, you're just weeping, you can't control that either. And then the same thing in Guatemala as well when I was traveling there. So it's not as if I was the one, you know, protesting in those situations, I just happened to be watching it. But I think that I do have a side of my personality that is attracted to the danger. You know, they told me not to go there, but I had to see, and I've done that before in New Orleans, a year before Katrina. They told me that there was this hood, the Magnolia Projects. Just don't go there. You can't go there. So, of course, I had to go. I had to see. So one of these days it'll come back to get me, I'm sure, even though a sensible gene has kind of kicked in at 30 somehow. But, you know, I can't help myself.
Yeah. Well, happy birthday for next month.
Next month?
It's October.
For me?
Yeah.
January. I already had my 30th.
You had your 30th.
Yeah, I had a very strange 30th, actually. I had it at Russell Crowe's house, would you believe? He was getting me to perform at a variety show that he was throwing up in Coffs Harbour, of all places. And I would just get up in amongst all these weird people, like One Direction's producer and, you know, a guy from Grinspoon, and suddenly, and then I'd be there just reciting poetry, so bringing it to the mainstream and
absolutely
to Hollywood.
So now tell me about Here Comes the Dogs, because that's just out in the bookstores about a month ago.
Yeah.
And it's doing great business. So how did you come to write that?
I'd always thought it would be nice to write a novel. It would be a huge accomplishment, but I didn't quite realize what I was getting myself into when I started it. And I was having a lot of trouble figuring out how to write prose. I'd never done that before. I'd never really written short stories or anything like that. So I just sort of leapt into it. But it was only when I read The Monkey's Mask by Dorothy Porter when I realized that you could paint vignettes very quickly and keep the plot going if you just made every single scene a different poem. And that came a bit easier to me, or more easily to me, than writing prose. And then after that, after I got the voices and I started telling the story, I could build some prose around that. So it's a third of it is in poetry, which is kind of cool that Penguin, you know, a major publisher, would put that out, because I'm not sure Penguin has published a verse novel or even a book of poetry in years and years. And I actually heard along the grapevine that there had been a previous head of publishing at Penguin a few decades ago who said, "Over my dead body will we ever publish any Australian poetry again." So I don't know what happened to that guy. Maybe he is dead. I'm not sure. but, yeah, Here Come the Dogs is out anyway.
So, and I hear it reflects on the experience of multicultural Australia. What do you mean by living on the hyphen?
I think there are a lot of people in this country, myself included, who live in between worlds. You know, people are very keen to box you in by genre, religion, race, whatever it is. But I've always been described as Malaysian hyphen Australian, but I'm neither quite Australian or quite Malaysian. So I think I live in that in-between space, a liminal space. And I'm interested in writing about those things because I think more and more Australians feel that way. And, you know, I also grew up between country and city. So there are all these things, overlapping things and issues at play. And I want to talk about those things, especially migration. You know, the push and pull of kind of the homeland and then Australia, and how things are not easy and they're complicated, despite the fact that the mainstream media and the government tries to simplify things and, you know, put stereotypes out there and be reductive. People of migrant backgrounds have complex stories, and they might be of minorities, but their stories matter. Their stories are important, and I want to describe those stories.
And do you feel that poetry can change the way we see ourselves?
I think it can help change the narrative a little bit. I'm not sure. I feel my way through these things quite intuitively when it comes to political ideologies and everything. and my politics. I'm not the type of person that could describe to you or define all the isms in the world. I sort of feel my way through it, but I like to encourage young people of all different backgrounds to express themselves through poetry. Because when I was growing up, there were only a few ways you could express yourself as a young man. Either footy or fighting in my hometown seemed to be the way. And I think it's really important to give people, young people, a different way of expressing themselves and their stories, and they can find liberation through that. Is it a political tool? I guess it is. If you teach someone a new way of expressing themselves, and then they can tell their stories, and that is maybe the most potent political tool of all.
Great. Would you like to share one last poem?
Sure. Well, I was talking about young people. So this is a poem I wrote for a bunch of young fellas that I was working with in Armidale, northern New South Wales, and they had been through a whole lot of hectic, crazy times in their lives, and I just wanted to write something for them. It's called Fireflies. She said, "As a child, I lived in the mountains. I used to collect fireflies in a jar and use the light to read my books. I said, what a beautiful world it is." She said, "Now, when I return to the mountains, there are no fireflies left." And I said, "What a heartbreaking world it is." So when our heroes grow old and our dreamers go mad, when our songbirds go silent, and fires burn on each corner, I live for the little wins. When there are footsteps in the hallways and I don't know whose they are, whether lover or torturer, ally or assassin, I live for the little wins. When there are hands over ears and tape over mouths, when I no longer know if I prefer to be awake or asleep, the silence of the undertow or the crashing of waves on a reef, when they promise us everything, they treat us like nothing. I live for the little wins. Like when you eat a meal and straight afterwards you realize that what you just ate, shit, bro, that was exactly what you felt like. Like when mangoes are $9 a box. Like a surprise email that makes your day. Like the first sip of water after a day-long fast. Like the first line after writer's block. Like a student who can barely spell her name but pens the perfect line. You see, I live for the things I'm ready to die for, and I stand for the things for which I'm willing to fall. Man, we all promise that to ourselves sometimes. We, the people, most fragile of all. We, the people who drag nets to the shore, hoping to find diamond rings in the guts of fish and pearls in the bellies of dragons. We, the men and women who stand inches from screens that scream at us to lose weight or gain funds. We, the seething mass of darlings and friends, rapists, racists, killers of men, romper stompers, heroes, fashionistas and feminists, protesters who swing their bats at the system, hoping the shards form mosaics, and lovers who swing for the fences. You see, this poem is for the outsiders, the eccentrics, the people living on the hyphens, the people who never let coolness whitewash their madness. It's for the kids on the mish, on the pavements, in the basements, in the flats, in the schoolyards. Man, it's even for the poets who write "This Is Four Poems." 3CR, this poem is for you. They will treat your voice like a crime for which you have no alibi. Yeah, so make it a crime of passion. Raise it at their eyes. Shoplift time. Pickpocket perseverance from the haters and leave the rest behind. Speak, speak, speak with purpose. Teeth brighter than a city spine. Little win though it may be, who knows, perhaps someday, one day, the fireflies will return.
Brilliant. It was wonderful to have you on, Omar. That was Omar Musa, and you're listening to 3CR Spoken Word. See you again next month.
So that was a recording of an interview with Omar Musa back in 2014. And this year, 2026, Omar Musa has won the Miles Franklin Award for Fierce Land. My name is Di Cousins, and this has been the 3CR Spoken Word Program.